Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Chapter 12 of Volume 2 of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, the Thomas Dalton translation. The only translation you want to do, unless you're making comparisons, to see where things might have been a bit twisted in the past. Chapter 12 is very short. It's called The Trade Union Question. That's all it deals with. And it begins on page 645. So let's turn there now. Chapter 12, The Trade Union Question. Due to the rapid growth of the movement, we felt compelled in 1922 to take a position on a question that has not yet been fully resolved. In our efforts to discover the best way for the movement to reach the hearts of the broad masses, we always confronted the objection that the worker could never completely belong to us as long as his purely vocational and economic interests were handled by our opponents and their political organization. So they got to separate the workers from the Marxists led by the Jews. This was quite a serious objection. The general belief was that a workman engaged in some trade could not exist if he didn't belong to a union. Not only were his professional interests thus protected, but a guarantee of steady employment was simply inconceivable without union membership. The majority of workers were in unions. In general, the unions had successfully conducted the battle for wages and had concluded agreements that guaranteed the worker a steady income. Undoubtedly, the workers in the various trades benefited from the results of that struggle. And especially for honest men, conflicts of conscience must have arisen if they took the wages that the union had won for them, but had withdrawn themselves from the fight. It was difficult to discuss this problem with the average bourgeois employer. He hadn't, or didn't wish to have, any understanding for either the material or moral side of the question. Finally, he declared that his own economic interests were in principle opposed to every kind of organizational grouping of workers under him. Hence, it was impossible for him to take an impartial view. Here, as so often, it was necessary to appeal to disinterested outsiders who would not be tempted to miss the forest for the trees. With some goodwill, they could much more easily understand a matter that is of the highest importance for our present and future life. 12.1. Are trade unions necessary? Think of right to work in the United States. In the first volume of this book, I already expressed my views on the nature, purpose, and necessity of trade unions. Footnote 182 reads, see sections, volume 1, chapter 217, 218, and 1119. There I explain that unless measures are undertaken to change the employer's attitude toward the worker, either by the state, usually feudal for the most part, or a comprehensive new education, the worker has no recourse except to appeal to his equal rights as a contracting party within the economic sphere. I further stated that this would conform to the interests of the national community if, in consequence, social injustices could be addressed that would otherwise cause serious damage to the whole structure, the whole social structure. I stated, moreover, that the worker would always find it necessary to undertake this protective action as long as there were some among the employers who had no sense of their social obligations or even of the most elementary human rights. And I concluded by saying that if such self-defense was considered necessary, it could only exist in the form of a workers' association on a trade union basis. So he's saying the employees have legitimate demands, and if the employers are going to ignore them, then it makes sense for them to associate in a trade union, the workers. Nothing changed this general conception of mine in 1922, but now it was necessary to find a clear and precise formula regarding these problems. We couldn't be satisfied with mere knowledge, but rather we had to arrive at some practical conclusions. The following questions had to be answered. Are trade unions necessary? Question one. Two, should the NSDAP itself operate on a union basis or direct its members to participate in any such form? Three, what would be the nature of a National Socialist Union? What are our tasks and aims? Four, how could we establish such unions? I think I've adequately answered the first question. As things stand, I'm convinced that we cannot dispense with unions. On the contrary, they are among the most important institutions in the economic life of the nation. Not only are they important in the social policy sphere, but even more so in overall national politics. When the broad masses of a nation see their vital needs satisfied through a sound trade union movement, the whole nation will be exceptionally strengthened in its struggle for existence. Above all, trade unions are necessary as building stones for the future economic parliament or chambers representing the various professions. The second question is also easy to answer. If the trade union movement is important, then it's clear that National Socialism ought to take a definite stand on it, not only theoretically, but also in practice. But the how is harder to explain. The National Socialist Movement, which aims at establishing a National Socialist focus state, must always bear in mind that every future institution in that state must grow from the movement itself. It's a great mistake to believe that, once in possession of power, and out of nothing, we can bring about a definite reorganization without the help of a certain reserve stock of men who have been trained in their conviction. Here, too, we uphold the principle that the spirit that fills a form is more important than the form itself, which can be created mechanically and rapidly. For example, the leadership principle can be imposed on a state organization. For example, the leadership principle, that is that the leader has all responsibility and authority. You have all responsibility below you and all and responsibility to the ones above you and authority over those below you, and that goes all the way to the top. The ultimate guy, Hitler, would have ultimate responsibility for everything, and he would also have ultimate authority to be able to carry out what needs to be done. For example, the leadership principle can be imposed on a state organism in a dictatorial way, but it comes alive only by passing through the necessary stages of development, starting from the smallest cell. It must pass through a process of selection lasting over several years and be tempered by the hard realities of life, thus obtaining the necessary leadership material to carry the principle into practical effect. One must also not imagine that a state constitution can suddenly be pulled out of a briefcase into the daylight and, in apostrophes, introduce it by decree. One can attempt such a thing, but the result will always be incapable of survival, something like a stillborn infant just starting from scratch on paper. This reminds me of the origins of the Weimar Constitution and the attempt to impose a new constitution and new flag on the German people, but without any interrelation to our people's experiences during the past half century. The National Socialist State must guard against all such experiments. It must grow out of an organization that has already existed for a long time. This organization must possess National Socialist life in itself so as to create a living National Socialist State. 12.2. National Socialist Unions? NS unions. As already stated, the germ cells of this state must lie in the administrative chambers, that will represent the various occupations and professions and, above all, the trade unions. If this subsequent representational body and the Central Economic Parliament are to be National Socialist institutions, these important germ cells must embody a National Socialist conviction and conception. The movement's institutions are to be transferred into the state, but the state cannot suddenly call these into existence from nothing unless they are to remain completely lifeless structures. Looking at it from the highest standpoint, the National Socialist Movement will have to recognize the necessity of its own trade union policy. It must furthermore do this because a real National Socialist education for the employer, as well as for the employee, in the spirit of mutual cooperation within a common framework of the national community, cannot be secured by theoretical instruction, appeals, and exhortations, but only through the struggles of daily life. So he wants this to be organic. We got to build it up now, and then you can't just make it out of nothing out of paper, is what he's saying in all this. In and through this spirit, the movement must educate the several large economic groups and bring them closer to one another on the main issues, that'd be the employers and the employees or the workers. Without this preparatory work, and think of their thing, the head and the hands, right? United by the heart, you might say. In and through this spirit, the movement must educate the several large economic groups and bring them closer to one another on the main issues. Look, guys, we're all in this for Germany and a better future. Let's keep that spirit in mind as we sit down at this table and work out any problems there might be. That sort of an approach. Without this preparatory work, it would be sheer illusion to hope that a real national community could someday arise. Only the great worldview ideal that the movement fights for can steadily form that general style, which will show that the new age rests on internally sound foundations and not merely on an external facade. Hence, the movement must adopt a positive attitude towards the trade union idea per se, but it must also provide its members and supporters with a practical education for the coming National Socialist state. The answer to the third question follows from what has been already said. The National Socialist Trade Union is not an instrument for class warfare, but a representative organ of the various occupational interests. The National Socialist state recognizes no classes, so-called in apostrophe, but politically speaking, it recognizes only citizens with absolutely equal rights and corresponding equal duties. And he outlined this in earlier chapters. And alongside these, it recognizes state subjects who have no political rights whatsoever. The National Socialist conception of the Union doesn't have the function of banding together certain men within the national community and thus gradually transforming them into a class so as to struggle against other similarly organized groups. We certainly cannot assign this task to the Union per se, but it became this when it was transformed into an instrument of Marxist struggle. The Union is not a tool of class struggle, but the Marxists made it into an instrument for use in their own class struggle. They created the economic weapon that the international world Jew, hyphenated world Jew, the Marxist created the economic weapon that the international world Jew uses for the purpose of shattering the economic foundations of free and independent national states and for destroying national industry and trade and thereby enslaving free peoples to serve a suprastate of Jewish world finance. Boy, is that not exactly what we have now? They sold away all of our manufacturing, and they Wall Streetized, they financialized, they took over all the shares of the largest companies and fed them out of the Fed. By contrast, the National Socialist Trade Union must organize definite groups of participants in the nation's economic life. It will thus enhance the security of the national economic system itself, reinforcing it by the elimination of all those anomalies that ultimately exercise a destructive influence on the national body, by damaging the vital forces of the national community, prejudicing the well-being of the state, and last but not least, bringing evil and ruin upon the economy. Therefore, for the National Socialist Union, the strike is not an instrument for disturbing and dislocating national production, but for increasing it and making it run smoothly by fighting against all those abuses which, by reason of their antisocial character, hinder economic efficiency and thereby the existence of the whole nation. Individual efficiency always stands in a causal relation to the general social and legal position of the individual in the economic process. It's the sole basis for the conviction that the nation's economic prosperity must necessarily benefit the individual citizen. The National Socialist employee must recognize the fact that national economic prosperity brings with it his own material happiness. The National Socialist employer must recognize that the happiness and contentment of his employees are necessary prerequisites for the existence and development of his own economic prosperity. National Socialist employees and employers are both servants and guardians of the whole national community. The large measure of personal freedom accorded to them for their activities can be explained by the fact that, as experience has shown, individual efficiency is more enhanced by a generous measure of freedom than by coercion from above. Sounds like a real tyrant, doesn't he? Furthermore, such freedom promotes the natural selection process that brings forth the ablest, most capable, and most industrious people. So he's not any kind of a Marxist. That's simply a conservative coward lie. For the National Socialist Union, therefore, the strike is a means that may, and indeed must, be enacted only as long as a National Socialist state does not yet exist. Once existing, the state will replace the mass struggle between the two great groups, employers and employees, which has always resulted in a decline in production and injury to the national community, with a concern in defense of the rights of all. The economic chamber's duty will be to keep the national economy operating and to remove any injurious defects or errors. That which is now fought over through a quarrel among millions will then be settled in the trades chambers and in the central economic parliament. In this way, executives and employees will no longer be drawn into a mutual conflict over wages and pay scales, damaging the economic interests of both. Rather, they will solve these problems together on a higher plane with the welfare of the national community and of the state as their shining ideal. Here again, as everywhere, the iron principle must be observed, as we move on to page 651, that the interests of the fatherland come before the party. Come before party, not the party, but party. So he's always put the good of the nation first. The National Socialist Union's task will be to educate and prepare for this goal itself, which is, all must work together for the maintenance and security of our people and our state, each according to their inborn abilities and powers, which have been trained by the national community. 12.3, no dual unions. The fourth question, how can we establish such unions, seems more difficult to answer. Generally speaking, it's easier to establish something on new ground than on an old terrain that already has something. In a place where there's no existing shop, it's easy to establish one. But it's harder if a similar enterprise already exists, and it's hardest of all when the conditions are such that only one alone can prosper. Here the founders not only must introduce their own business, but they must also destroy the one that's already there, if they are to exist. It would be senseless to have a National Socialist Union alongside other unions. It must have a thorough feeling for its philosophical task and the resulting obligation not to tolerate other similar or hostile organizations. It must insist on the necessity of itself alone. It can come to no understanding and no compromise with related efforts, but must assert its own absolute and exclusive right. There are two ways that might lead to such a development. One, we could establish our own union and then gradually take up the fight against the international Marxist unions. Or we could, two, enter into the Marxist unions and infuse them with a new spirit, with the idea of transforming them into instruments of a new ideal. The first way was not advisable for the following reasons. Our financial situation was still the cause of much worry to us at that time, and our resources were quite slender. The effects of the steadily increasing inflation made the particular situation still more difficult for us, because in those years one could scarcely speak of any material benefit for a union member. From his point of view, the individual worker had no reason to pay his union dues. Even the existing Marxist unions were on the brink of collapse until, as the result of Herr Kuno's enlightened Ruhr policy, millions suddenly poured into their laps. This so-called National Reich Chancellor should be designated as the redeemer of the Marxist unions. Footnote 183. Wilhelm Kuno, C-U-N-O, 1876 to 1933, served as German Chancellor for a short period in late 1922 and early 1923. He was in office when France occupied the Ruhr Valley, beginning on 11 January 1923. This was also the time at which the infamous German hyperinflation first took hold. Thanks to these disastrous events, the inflation in France occupying the Ruhr, Marxist unions experienced a surge in support. At that time, we couldn't count on similar financial possibilities, and no one could be induced to enter a new union that, on account of its financial weakness, couldn't offer the slightest benefit. On the other hand, I felt bound to oppose creating any such organization that would only be a shelter for more or less great minds. Overall, the question of personnel played the most important role. I didn't have, then, a single man whom I could call upon to handle this important task. Whoever could have succeeded at that time in shattering the Marxist unions to make way for the triumph of the National Socialist Union idea, and thereby displaced the destructive class struggle, would have ranked among the greatest men of our nation, and his bust would have deserved a place in the Valhalla at Regensburg for the admiration of posterity. Footnote 184. The Valhalla, with a W, is a neoclassical building in Regensburg that houses plaques and busts honoring a variety of German national heroes. It is named after the Valhalla of Norse mythology. And I actually was in Regensburg when I was over there. I thought it was a really nice town, kind of cool place, Regensburg. R-E-G-E-N-S-B-U-R-G. But I knew of no one who qualified for such a pedestal who could do the work needed for the unions. It's totally false to be led astray by the fact that the international trade unions are conducted by men of only mediocre minds. In reality, this means nothing at all. When they were founded, there was nothing else. Today, the National Socialist Movement must fight against a long-standing and monstrous organization that is developed down to the smallest details. The conqueror must always be smarter than the defender if he is to subdue him. The Marxist trade union fortress can be governed today by mediocre leaders, but it can only be stormed by the dauntless energy and genius ability of a great leader on the other side. If such a man cannot be found, it's futile to bicker with fate, and even more foolish to force the issue without adequate replacement. Here one must apply the maxim that, in life, it's often better to let something go than to try it halfway or to do it poorly due to a lack of suitable forces. He's big on that. He's big on no half measures, but here he's saying don't even try unless you can really do it correctly, and don't kid yourself about that. 12.4, Battle of the Worldviews come first. Battle of Worldviews. And again, these are from Dalton. They're not in Hitler's original. The sections are created by Dalton. The section titles are given by Dalton. Of course, they're taken directly from the text in what is about to follow. 12.4, Battle of the Worldviews come first. And I think there's only like 6-7 in this whole chapter. So it's not, let's see here, super long. Oh, actually, not even that. There's only 5. So this is the penultimate, the fourth of 5. 12.4, Battle of Worldviews come first. To this, we must add another consideration, which is not at all demagogic. At that time I had, and still have today, a firm conviction that it's dangerous to mix up a great politico-worldview struggle with economic questions at an early time. This applies particularly to our German people. In such a case, the economic struggle would divert energy from the political fight. Once the people come to believe that they can buy a little house with their savings, they'll devote themselves solely to this task. No spare time will be left for the political struggle against those who, one way or another, will someday take away their savings. Instead of fighting in the political conflict on behalf of the opinions and convictions they have won, they'll surrender to their settlement idea, in apostrophe settlement, and in the end will lose out. Today, the National Socialist Movement is at the beginning of its struggle. In large part, it must shape and finalize its worldview picture. It must employ every fiber of its energy in the struggle for acceptance of its great ideals, and success is conceivable only if its total strength is put into service of this fight. We have today a classical example of how active fighting strength becomes paralyzed by being preoccupied with purely economic problems. The revolution of November 1918 wasn't made by the trade unions, but rather was carried out against them. And the German people didn't wage any political fight for the future of Germany because they thought that they could secure it sufficiently by constructive economic work. We should learn from this experience. It would be no different for us. The more the combined strength of our movement is concentrated on the political struggle, the sooner we can count on success down the line. But the more we prematurely busy ourselves with union, settlement, and other problems, the less will be the benefit for our cause as a whole. These are important matters, but they cannot be resolved until we put political power to use in the service of these ideas. Until then, these problems can only paralyze the movement, and if it takes them up too soon, they will prove a hindrance to the philosophical will. It may then easily happen that union motives would control the political movement instead of the worldview directing the union. The movement and the nation can derive advantage from a national socialist trade union movement only if, in its worldview, it's so thoroughly inspired by National Socialist ideas that it runs no danger of falling into Marxist tracks. A National Socialist union movement that considered itself only as a competitor to the Marxist unions would be worse than none at all. It must declare war against the Marxist unions, not only as an organization, but above all, as an idea. It must strike down the promoter of the class idea and class warfare, and in its place declare itself as the defender of the occupational interests of the German people. 12.5. Better no foundation than a failed one. All these viewpoints argued then and still argue against the founding of our own trade union. Unless, that is, someone suddenly appears who is obviously called by fate to solve this particular problem. Thus, there are only two other possibilities. Either we recommend that our own party members leave the unions, or that they remain in them for now while working as destructively as possible. In general, I recommended the latter way. Especially in the years 1922-23, we could easily do that. During the inflation period, the financial advantage to the union from our members was almost zero due to the few individuals in our young movement. But the damage to the union was great because the National Socialist supporters were its sharpest critics. At the time, I had already rejected all experiments that were destined to fail. I would have considered it criminal to deprive a worker of his scant earnings for an institution that I felt offered no real advantages to its members. If a new political party should fade out of existence one day, no one would be injured and some would have profited, but none would have a right to complain. That which each individual gives to a political movement, he gives à fonds perdu. Footnote 185, French cat phrase for literature, lost funds, that is, money given with no expectation of return. But he who pays his dues to a union has the right to expect some guarantee in return. If this is not done, then the union leaders are swindlers, or at least careless people who ought to be held responsible. We acted on these views in 1922. Others thought differently and founded trade unions. They attacked us for being short-sighted and mistaken. But it wasn't long after before these organizations disappeared, and the same would have happened to us, but only with one difference. We would not have deceived ourselves or others. And that's all in Chapter 12, Volume 2, about his attitude toward trade unions. He's saying, hey, I don't have the right guy. I'm not going to just form a union and pay people pay in when I can't do anything for them. And they have enough problems as it is. Maybe the right guy will come along. Until then, the people who are in these unions, hey, fuck with the Marxist if you're in one of those unions. And in any way, economics are subordinated to the political view. But so far as we think of economics, we got to have employers and employees pulling together on the same page for the good of the nation and the race. And the employers got to think about what's good for the employees, and the employees have their space, give labor its due is one way of formulating it. And don't just think that you can rip them off. But class doesn't matter. We're all equal. He said absolute equality of citizens. So the class thing may be a social fact, but it's head and hands working together. And that's what you're to think about Nazi economic policy. And also you'll know that contrary to them always calling the libertarian liars and the conservative Catholic cowards are always saying, oh, you know, Hitler was a tyrant and oppressive, and he was basically just another version of leftist, communist, Marxist. But he specifically says we give individuals a lot of scope to figure things out because that's what actually works. Hitler is big on the individual and the personality, not just mass numbers, but the personality and also absolute responsibility and authority. So he's not at all like he's painted. Anyway, this has been recording number 31. I forgot to say that at the start, but recording 31, Thomas Dalton's translation of Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler, Volume 2, Chapter 12, you've been listening to. I'm Alex Linder. You can find everything at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you for more. There's just a few more chapters left real soon.